Ambangala Manura
Yes, 13. The Nipponese businessman lies cut in segments on the Black Sun's floor. Surprisingly, he looks so real when he's in one piece. No flesh, blood, or organs are visible through the new cross-sections that Hero's sword made through his body. He is nothing more than a thin shell of epidermis, an incredibly complex inflatable doll. But the air does not rush out of him. He fails to collapse, and you can look into the aperture of a sword cut and see, instead of bones and meat, the back of the skin on the other side. It breaks the metaphor. The avatar is not acting like a real body. It reminds all the Black Sun's patrons that they are living in a fantasy world. People hate to be reminded of this. When Hero wrote the Black Sun's sword-fighting algorithms, code that was later picked up and adopted by the entire metaverse, he discovered that there was no good way to handle the aftermath. Avatars are not supposed to die, not supposed to fall apart. The creators of the metaverse had not been morbid enough to foresee a demand for this kind of thing. But the whole point of a sword fight is to cut someone up and kill them. So Hero had to clutch something together in order that the metaverse would not, over time, become littered with inert, dismembered avatars that never decayed. So the first thing that happens when someone loses a sword fight is that his computer gets disconnected from the global network that is the metaverse. He gets chucked right out of the system. It is the closest simulation of death that the metaverse can offer. But all it really does is cause the user a lot of annoyance. Furthermore, the user finds that he can't get back into the metaverse for a few minutes. He can't log back on. This is because his avatar, dismembered, is still in the metaverse, and it's a rule that your avatar can't exist in two places at once. So the user can't get back in until his avatar has been disposed of. Disposal of hacked-up avatars is taken care of by Graveyard Demons, a new metaverse feature that Hero had to invent. They are small, lithe persons swathed in black, like ninjas, not even their eyes showing. They are quiet and efficient. Even as Hero is stepping back from the hacked-up body of his former opponent, they are emerging from invisible trap doors in the Black Sun's floor, climbing up out of the netherworld, converging on the fallen businessman. Within seconds, they have stashed the body parts into black bags. Then they climb back down through their secret trap doors and vanish into hidden tunnels beneath the Black Sun's floor. A couple of curious patrons try to follow them, try to pry open the trap doors, but their avatar's fingers find nothing but smooth matte black. The tunnel system is accessible only to the Graveyard Demons, and, incidentally, to Hero, but he rarely uses it. The Graveyard Demons will take the avatar to the pyre, an eternal underground bonfire beneath the center of the Black Sun, and burn it. As soon as the flames consume the avatar, it will vanish from the metaverse, and then its owner will be able to sign on as usual, creating a new avatar to run around in. But hopefully, he will be more cautious and polite the next time around. Hero looks up into the circle of applauding, whistling, and cheering avatars and notes that they are fading out. The entire Black Sun now looks like it is being projected on gauze. On the other side of that gauze, bright lights shine through, overwhelming the image. Then it disappears entirely. He peels off his goggles and finds himself standing in the parking lot of the used store, holding a naked katana. The sun has just gone down. A couple of dozen people are standing around him at a great distance, shielding themselves behind parked cars, awaiting his next move. Most of them are pretty scared, but a few of them are just plain excited. Vitaly Chernobyl is standing in the open door of their 20x30. His hairdo is backlighted. It has been petrified by means of egg whites and other proteins. These substances refract the light and throw off tiny little spectral fragments, a cluster-bombed rainbow. Right now, a miniature image of the Black Sun is being projected onto Vitaly's ass by Hero's computer. He is rocking unsteadily from foot to foot, as though standing on both of them at the same time is too complicated to deal with this early in the day, and he hasn't decided which one to use. You're blocking me, Hiro says.
It's time to go, Vitali says.
You're telling me it's time to go? I've been waiting for you to wake up for an hour. As Hiro approaches, Vitali watches his sword uncertainly. Vitali's eyes are dry and red, and on his lower lip he is sporting a chancre the size of a tangerine.
Did you win your sword fight?
Of course I won the fucking sword fight, Hiro says. I'm the greatest sword fighter in the world.
And you wrote the software.
Yeah, that too, Hiro says. After Vitali Chernobyl and the Meltdowns arrived in Long Beach on one of those hijacked ex-Soviet refugee freighters, they fanned out across Southern California looking for expanses of reinforced concrete that were as vast and barren as the ones they had left behind in Kiev. They weren't homesick. They needed such environments in order to practice their art. The LA River was a natural site, and there were plenty of nice overpasses. All they had to do was follow skateboarders to the secret places they had long since discovered. Thrashers and nuclear fuzz grunge collectives thrive in the same environment. That's where Vitali and Hiro are going right now. Vitali has a really old VW Vanagon, the kind with a pop top that turns it into a makeshift camper. He used to live in it, staying on the street or in various snooze and cruise franchises, until he met up with Hiro Protagonist. Now the ownership of the Vanagon is subject to dispute because Vitali owes Hiro more money than it is technically worth, so they share it. They drive the Vanagon around to the other side of the U-store it, honking the horn and flashing the lights in order to shoo 100 little kids away from the loading dock. It's not a playground, kids. They pick their way down a broad corridor, excusing themselves every inch of the way as they step over little Mayan encampments and Buddhist shrines and white trash stoned on vertigo, apple pie, fuzzy buzzy, narthex, mustard, and the like. The floor needs sweeping. Used syringes, crack vials, charred spoons, pipe stems. There are also many little tubes, about thumb-sized, transparent plastic with a red cap on one end. They might be crack vials, but the caps are still on them, and pipettes wouldn't be so fastidious as to replace the lid on an empty vial. It must be something new Hiro hasn't heard of before. The McDonald's Styrofoam burger box of drug containers. They push through a fire door into another section of the U-Storage, which looks the same as the last one. Everything looks the same in America. There are no transitions now. Vitali owns the third locker on the right, a puny 5x10 that he is actually using for its intended purpose, storage. Vitali steps up to the door and commences trying to remember the combination to the padlock, which involves a certain amount of random guessing. Finally, the lock snaps and pops open. Vitali shoots the bolt and swings the door open, sweeping a clean half-circle through the drug paraphernalia. Most of the 5x10 is occupied by a couple of large, four-wheeled flatbed handcarts piled high with speakers and amps. Hiro and Vitali wheel the carts down to the loading dock, put the stuff into the Vanagon, and then return the empty carts to the 5x10. Technically, the carts are community property, but no one believes that. The drive to the scene of the concert is long, made longer by the fact that Vitali, rejecting the technocentric LA view of the universe in which speed is God, likes to stay on the surface and drive at about 35 miles per hour. Traffic is not great either, so Hiro jacks his computer into the cigarette lighter and goggles into the metaverse. He is no longer connected to the network by a fiber optic cable, and so all his communication with the outside world has to take place via radio waves, which are much slower and less reliable. Going into the black sun would not be practical. It would look and sound terrible, and the other patrons would look at him as if he were some kind of black and white person. But there's no problem with going into his office, because that's generated within the guts of his computer, which is sitting on his lap. He doesn't need any communication with the outside world for that. He materializes in his office, in his nice little house in the old hacker neighborhood just off the street. It is all quite Nipponese. Tatami mats cover the floor. His desk is a great ruddy slab of rough sawn mahogany. Silvery cloud light filters through rice paper walls. A panel in front of him slides open to reveal a garden, complete with babbling brook and steelhead trout jumping out from time to time to grab flies. Technically speaking, the pond should be full of carp, but Hero is American enough to think of carp as inedible dinosaurs that sit on the bottom and eat sewage. There is something new. A globe about the size of a grapefruit, a perfectly detailed rendition of planet Earth, hanging in space at arm's length in front of his eyes. Hero has heard about this, but never seen it. It is a piece of CIC software, called simply Earth. It is the user interface that CIC uses to keep track of every bit of spatial information that it owns. All the maps, weather data, architectural plans, and satellite surveillance stuff. Hero has been thinking that in a few years, if he does really well in the Intel biz, maybe he will make enough money to subscribe to Earth and get this thing in his office. Now, it is suddenly here, free of charge. The only explanation he can come up with is that Juanita must have given it to him. But first things first. The Babel Infocalypse card is still in his avatar's pocket. He takes it out. One of the rice paper panels that make up the walls of his office slides open. On the other side of it, Hero can see a large, dimly lit room that wasn't there before. Apparently, Juanita came in and made a major addition to his house as well. A man walks into the office. The librarian demon looks like a pleasant 50-ish silver-haired bearded man with bright blue eyes, wearing a V-neck sweater over a work shirt, with a coarsely woven, tweedy-looking wool tie. The tie is loosened, the sleeves pushed up. Even though he's just a piece of software, he has reason to be cheerful. He can move through the nearly infinite stacks of information in the library with the agility of a spider dancing across a vast web of cross-references. The librarian is the only piece of CIC software that costs even more than Earth. The only thing he can't do is think.
"Yes, sir,"
the librarian says. He is eager without being obnoxiously chipper. He clasps his hands behind his back, rocks forward slightly on the balls of his feet, raises his eyebrows expectantly over his half-glasses. "Babel's a city in Babylon, right?"
"It was a legendary city," the librarian says. "Babel is a biblical term for Babylon. The word is Semitic. Bab means gate, and El means God. So Babel means gate of God. But it is probably also somewhat onomatopoeic, imitating someone who speaks in an incomprehensible tongue. The Bible is full of puns."
"They built a tower to heaven and God knocked it down."
"This is an anthology of common misconceptions. God did not do anything to the tower itself. And the Lord said, 'Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech.' So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth." Genesis 11:6-9, Revised Standard Version.
"So the tower wasn't knocked down. It just went on hiatus."
"Correct. It was not knocked down."
"But that's bogus."
"Bogus?"
"Provably false. Juanita believes that nothing is provably true or provably false in the Bible. Because if it's provably false, then the Bible is a lie. And if it's provably true, then the existence of God is proven and there's no room for faith. The Babel story is provably false because if they built a tower to heaven and God didn't knock it down, then it would still be around somewhere, or at least a visible remnant of it."
"In assuming that it was very tall, you are relying on an obsolete reading. The tower is described literally as its top with the heavens. For many centuries, this was interpreted to mean that its top was so high that it was in the heavens. But in the last century or so, as actual Babylonian ziggurats have been excavated, astrological diagrams, pictures of the heavens, have been found inscribed into their tops.
Oh, okay. So the real story is that a tower was built with heavenly diagrams carved into its top, which is far more plausible than a tower that reaches to the heavens.
More than plausible, the librarian reminds him. Such structures have actually been found.
Anyway, you're saying that when God got angry and came down on them, the tower itself wasn't affected, but they had to stop building the tower because of an informational disaster. They couldn't talk to each other.
Disaster is an astrological term meaning bad star, the librarian points out. Sorry, but due to my internal structure, I am a sucker for non sequiturs.
That's okay, really, Hero says. You're a pretty decent piece of ware. Who wrote you, anyway?
For the most part, I write myself, the librarian says. That is, I have the innate ability to learn from experience. But this ability was originally coded into me by my creator.
Who wrote you? Maybe I know him, Hero says. I know a lot of hackers.
I was not coded by a professional hacker per se, but by a researcher at the Library of Congress who taught himself how to code, the librarian says. He devoted himself to the common problem of sifting through vast amounts of irrelevant detail in order to find significant gems of information. His name was Dr. Emmanuel Lagos.
I've heard the name, Hero says. So he was kind of a meta-librarian. That's funny. I guessed he was one of those old CIA spooks who hangs around in the CIC.
He never worked with the CIA.
Okay, let's get some work done. Look up every piece of free information in the library that contains L. Bob Reif and arrange it in chronological order. The emphasis here is on free.
Television and newspapers, yes, sir. One moment, sir, the librarian says.
He turns around and exits on crepe soles. Hero turns his attention to Earth. The level of detail is fantastic. The resolution, the clarity, just the look of it, tells Hero or anyone else who knows computers that this piece of software is some heavy shit. It's not just continents and oceans. It looks exactly like the Earth would look from a point in geosynchronous orbit directly above LA, complete with weather systems, vast spinning galaxies of clouds hovering just above the surface of the globe, casting gray shadows on the oceans, and polar ice caps fading and fragmenting into the sea. Half of the globe is illuminated by sunlight and half is dark. The Terminator, the line between night and day, has just swept across L.A. and is now creeping across the Pacific, off to the west. Everything is going in slow motion. Hero can see the clouds change shape if he watches them long enough. Looks like a clear night on the East Coast. Something catches his attention moving rapidly over the surface of the globe. He thinks it must be a gnat, but there are no gnats in the metaverse. He tries to focus on it. The computer, bouncing low-powered lasers off his cornea, senses this change in emphasis, and then Hero gasps as he seems to plunge downward toward the globe, like a spacewalking astronaut who has just fallen out of his orbital groove. When he finally gets it under control, he's just a few hundred miles above the Earth, looking down at a solid bank of clouds, and he can see the gnat gliding along below him. It's a low-flying CIC satellite, swinging north to south in a polar orbit.
Your information, sir, the librarian says.
Hero startles and glances up. Earth swings down and out of his field of view, and there is the librarian standing in front of the desk, holding out a hypercard. Like any librarian in reality, this demon can move around without audible footfalls.
Can you make a little more noise when you walk?
I'm easily startled, Hero says.
It is done, sir. My apologies.
Hero reaches out for the hypercard. The librarian takes half a step forward and leans toward him. This time, his foot makes a soft noise on the tatami mat, and Hero can hear the white noise of his trousers sliding over his leg. Hero takes the hypercard and looks at it. The front is labeled. Results of library search on Reif.
Lawrence Robert, born 1948. He flips the card over. The back is divided into several dozen fingernail-sized icons. Some of them are little snapshots of the front pages of newspapers. Many of them are colorful glowing rectangles, miniature television screens showing live video.
That's impossible, Hero says. I'm sitting in a VW van, okay? I'm jacked in over a cellular link. You couldn't have moved that much video into my system that fast.
It was not necessary to move anything, the librarian says. All existing video on L. Bob Reif was collected by Dr. Lagos and placed in the Babel Infocalypse stack, which you have in your system.